Why does cheese and macaroni sound wrong?
Is it by accident or on accident?
And what's wrong with the American Young Singer?
We're verbing nouns, flattening adverbs, and discussing all things grammar today with Grammar Girl herself here on this episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of the forthcoming book, Useless Etymology. And today we have a special guest, our first ever guest, to discuss all things grammar with us. I am so excited to introduce my friend, Mignon Fogarty, known for years now as Grammar Girl, the Grammar Girl across the web. Truly a word legend of the internet. She's an author, podcaster, educator, blogger, short form video personality, and many more things. Mignon, welcome.
Thank you, Jess. I am so excited to be here. So honored to be your first guest.
We're so thrilled to have you because if anyone has ever Googled a grammatical question, there's a good chance, whether they've known it or not, that the answer that they've read, the definitive one, was written by Mignon. So we've got the right person here.
Can you give us a rundown on how you became Grammar Girl and when?
I've been doing this, gosh, almost 20 years, believe it or not. And I was working as a science and technology writer and editor in Silicon Valley. And because I love technology, I heard about this new thing called podcasting. And I wanted to try it. I wanted to do it. And I realized for my editing clients, I was correcting the same mistakes over and over again. And because I was using different style guides, sometimes AP, sometimes Chicago, I was constantly looking things up myself and creating weird little memory tricks to help me remember all the different rules. And I thought, well, maybe people would like, you know, a quick and dirty tip about grammar once a week. You know, something my mom always said, oh, let's just do a quick and dirty job on these dishes or something like that. Yeah. So I started Grammar Girl's Quick and Dirty Tips for Better Writing, largely on a whim and to play with podcasting. I went down to the coffee shop and, you know, wrote out three quick scripts and put them up on, back then it was called iTunes, not Apple Podcasts. And it just rocketed up the charts. It was unbelievable. It was number one for a while. It's just this little show about writing.
It really matters to people in this day and age because we write a lot. Now, day to day, we do a lot of writing. We produce a lot of text and grammar is at the center of all of that. And actually, there are a few things, you know, you've been doing this for two decades. I'm going to be interested to hear about sort of modern changes in grammar that have happened just over that period. And also, I just wanted to ask you a really basic question, and that is, so what is grammar?
Oh, no, it is the first line. You didn't know this, but it's the first line in the first sentence of my first book is about how I call myself Grammar Girl, but my dirty little secret is that I'm not talking about grammar most of the time. And, you know, I'm talking about usage and punctuation. You know, when I'm talking about which versus that, who versus whom, that's like barely grammar. That's usage. You know, how to use a semicolon? Definitely not grammar. That's punctuation. That's mechanics. You know, and so it's funny, like early on, I would get some criticism from linguists and people like that would say, you're not even talking about grammar. How could you call yourself Grammar Girl? But, you know, my argument is always that the average person, if you go up to someone on the street and ask them what grammar is, it's going to be all those things. It's the things they learned in school about writing. And so I feel like I'm using the common definition of grammar, the understood meaning of what is grammar.
And in the interest of this being an etymology podcast, that definition has changed dramatically throughout its history. Like in Latin and Greek, grammar was a much broader field of study referring to any type of learning and scholarship, but primarily language. And then when it ported over into English, it was Latin and French learning. And then over time, grammar school was extended to any type of schooling, and then we narrowed back down to words and language and usage.
I love that grammar and glamour come from the same. Roy Peter Clark has a book called The Glamour of Grammar because the words are related.
When you talk about usage versus grammar, if you're trying to decide whether to use that or which, it does depend on the grammar of the sentence, doesn't it? Which one you choose. So they're intertwined.
They are, yeah. It's restrictive versus non-restrictive clause. That's grammar. Usage is more like, you know, affect versus effect or something like that. Word choice.
One of my favorite things that Mignon does too, in addition to her podcast, is she teaches AP style workshops. So she's always observing these the wonderful ways in which what is commonly accepted by one style guide or another is evolving over time. And Rob and I are very much descriptivists versus prescriptivists. And I think you are too.
Yeah. I mean, that's one big thing that's changed for me over the years. You know, I started as a working editor and primarily was looking up rules and talking about rules and saying what was right or wrong. And it is just so much more interesting to talk about the way language changes and the history of language. So, you know, I do that a lot more these days. I still talk about the rules, but I work in a whole lot more about language change and language history and just the things that make language fun and interesting.
And just the very fact that there are multiple style guides tells you that grammar is not fixed, right?
Right,
there are
exactly.
Not that sometimes there are right and wrong answers. Of course, you have to be understood. But there is disagreement over some of the points that many people hold sacred, which I think might be a good route for us to go down in this podcast. Those sort of commonly held beliefs about grammatical errors that maybe are errors themselves? I don't know.
Right. Mignon talks about this a lot in The Grammar Daily there. This is a really fun book, by the way. It has a lot of exercises and interactivity, including puzzles and things too, which I really enjoy. But some of what we are going to talk about today appears in these pages.
I will die on the hill that using a serial comma, the Oxford comma, is a style choice. So the AP style doesn't use it in simple sentences. I use it. I love it. My house style is essentially AP, but with the serial comma. But it is a style choice. It is not wrong to not use it in simple sentences.
So this is if you've got three options, putting a comma before the and that goes before the final option, which is something I was taught not to do at school, but I have since sort of adopted. But not in all cases, like you say. I mean, I think it's sometimes feels right and sometimes it doesn't.
A lot of people were taught like it's either you absolutely have to put it in or you absolutely have to leave it out. And it you know, you don't.
If your sentence is understandable.
Right. And if you're following AP style, then you don't use it in a sentence like red, white, and blue. It's just so simple, you don't need it. But if you're following Chicago style, you would use it.
When you definitely do use it, are those situations where you've perhaps got two ands involved in the same sentence?
Exactly. Yeah. Anytime there'd be confusion, you want to use it. Of course, it's, you know, writing is about clarity. So in sentences that go beyond the simple, then you should essentially always use it.
Something else that you've written about that's commonly sort of picked up on by people who would describe themselves as pedants, to be fair, and they're correct, is less and fewer. It's something I've talked about on my own channel before, less versus fewer. Can you just explain to us what the commonly held belief is and whether or not it's correct?
Yeah, this is really interesting because there's a traditional rule that a lot of people learn that you use less for things that are uncountable and fewer for things that are countable. But then there are all these exceptions like time, money, distance. There's a rule that actually the Chicago Manual of Style uses too, is singular versus plural instead. And so you use less for things that are singular and fewer for things that are plural. And then that takes care of all the exceptions. Because think of it this way, amounts of money. You wouldn't say $100 are a lot of money. You would say $100 is a lot of money. It's singular.
Oh.
And so then, you know, you use less, you know, less than $100. Because it's singular. And it also covers the rule that people get confused about is when you're talking about one, is it one less banana or one fewer banana? And a lot of people will think it's fewer because bananas are countable, but one banana is singular. And so it's one less banana. So that plural singular rule, which isn't how most people learn it, that is the one that covers all the ways we naturally use those words anyway that sound right to us.
Ooh, I didn't know this. Hang on. So
this is a revelation to me as well. I've never differentiated in this way. I've done the sort of continuous versus discrete thing. But never this singular plural.
Yeah, I always thought it had to do with definite versus indefinite amount. And this is blowing my mind because, you know, like you wouldn't say like fewer sugar or fewer gasoline. But okay, so are people right to take a Sharpie to their local grocery store signage that says 15 items or less?
Oh, that's a tougher one. So Merriam-Webster says it's idiomatic to have 10 items or less. It basically, and all that just means is we all kind of agree that that sounds right.
There's zero ambiguity in that.
Right. It somewhat violates the rule. It violates the rule. But then there is like this one way of thinking about it. So we use many or much. So many is how many is for countable and how much is for non-countable, right? So if you're standing there looking at the conveyor belt in the grocery store, you know, you could say, how many am I allowed to bring through, or how much am I allowed to bring through? So you're thinking of, are you thinking of your groceries as individual items or as like this mass of groceries that you're putting on the conveyor belt? So that is an argument you can use to say 10 items or less is acceptable. But really, I think it's just that idiomatic kind of thing. Like we've seen it on signs so much, we accept it.
The massive supermarket chain in Britain, Tesco, got in hot water for its 10 items or less sign. It was a few years ago, it's over a decade. Do you know what their solution was? Do you know what they changed it to?
It's such a, what'd they do?
A depressing cop out. They changed it to up to 10 items.
Just
which
work around
means
it.
Something else, because that means nine max, doesn't it?
It does.
Not having it.
I just feel like, you know, I'll die on the hill of the serial comma. I just don't feel like I want to die on the hill of 10 items or less.
Yeah, it just doesn't
matter.
There is an interesting note in the Guardian style guide about this, though. And they point out that there is a clear difference between fewer bad people and less bad people. Right? Because fewer bad people is fewer in number, less bad people
are less
bad. We don't know how many there are, but they're not as bad. You know what I mean? In these situations, it really does matter. But in other situations, it feels to me like fewer is a subsection of less. And by the way, you can find it being used in the way that people get very upset by, you know, as far back as the 1500s, you know, Henry VIII's time. And if that is in any way a measure of how correct something is, that it's been done for centuries, then it's okay.
That's why people who get real tied up about the figurative use of the word literally, I can't get behind that, because like Mark Twain used it, Dickens used literally to mean figuratively. And so did, let's see, it's in F. Scott Fitzgerald's works. And Jane Austen even makes fun of people for being pedantic about it subtly in her works too.
I do find myself reaching to my own defense on grammar points by just looking back at past quotes and finding people who did it hundreds of years ago.
So How long has it been wrong?
In my newsletter the other day, I used the phrase, the choice between small, medium and large. And I got a few emails saying, you should have said among there, not between. Because between is only between two people. I thought, well, a choice among small, medium, large sounds very unnatural to me. So I go to the OED and I have a look and it says, ha-ha, one or more items. And there's a quote from Samuel Johnson where he lists three. Vindicated. But am I vindicated? Is this one of those issues that you've heard, Mignon, of the whole among versus between thing?
Absolutely. And again, like if you dig deep into the rule, when you're talking about a choice between distinct items, you can use between for more than two. So, you know, if you're saying like she was choosing between, you know, Harvard, Yale and Princeton, like between is right. You wouldn't say she's choosing among Harvard, Yale and Princeton. Like it just, they're distinct units.
100% vindicators. Great. Thank you very much, Mignon. That's exactly what I need to hear. And the quote that I will be sending to everyone who emailed me about this. But I completely get their point though, right? Because you are among a crowd, you're not between a crowd. So there is a difference between and among. I just think it maybe doesn't work when you're talking about decisions, etc.
Rob and I have talked a lot before about the fact that because of the topic we discuss, and I'm sure you get this too, we're not allowed to make mistakes without someone being like, aha, I thwarted the word nerd.
I'm sure
you're not either, right?
That's why my show is scripted, or was scripted for so many years. So now, like, my Tuesday show is scripted. That's sort of like the traditional original show that's about rules and stuff. That is completely scripted because you're just not allowed to make mistakes, right? But then I've sort of loosened up, and now on Thursdays I have interviews, and those shows are obviously not scripted and more loose, but yeah, people do have higher expectations of people who make word shows, which is fair.
Absolutely. Speaking of which, we got into a discussion. Rob really has an aversion to the word winningest. And it's because it just sounds too, it's a superlative that doesn't feel right. And so you mentioned, we in the run-up to the show, you mentioned funnest as another form of superlative adjective resistance. So why do we, why does this feel weird versus most fun?
No, it's super interesting because, you know, before I became Grammar Girl, I didn't even know that some people object to using fun as an adjective, you know, saying that was a fun party.
Oh, like, I didn't either.
Okay, that's new to, I didn't know it until now.
Oh, really? Okay. Oh, okay. So like older people, you know, like our grandparents, they thought it was wrong to say a fun party. Fun was a noun. That party was a lot of fun. But you couldn't say a fun party. It was considered wrong as an adjective.
What it was? It was a droll party.
A delightful party.
Fun is a thing you have.
Yeah, fun was not an adjective. It just wasn't. They didn't think of fun as an adjective. And then, you know, I'm not sure exactly when it started, but I think it was in the 50s or so, that, or the 60s, that people started using fun pretty regularly as an adjective. But it was still controversial. Like when I started Grammar Girl 20 years ago or so, like I would still get calls from older people saying, you know, you really shouldn't be saying fun, and you have a fun show. You know, I made a card game at one point and I debated whether to call it a fun game in the advertising because I had gotten complaints, but I did. Fun. It's a fun game. But and so because there's this objection to fun as an adjective that has largely gone away, but it seems like the superlative has lagged in acceptance. So, right. So like people were like, okay, fun can be an adjective, but funnest is a bridge too far. You know, like there was still that objection to funner and funnest.
So people are okay with most fun though, are they?
I think it would draw less attention because people are used to hearing fun as an adjective now, but adding that next step, that like what all adjectives do, you know, it was furry, it was furrier, it was furriest. And that's a weird example, but you know, we do that with all our adjectives, but fun, I think because it's such a new adjective, we aren't as used to hearing those words. And so I think that's why they stand out.
I do hear Rob's objection to winningest too, because you wouldn't say like excitingest. It seems that you wouldn't turn as many like participles into superlatives typically if they already have the ing on the end.
There's actually a rule about the number of syllables in a word. So if it's three syllables or more, you're supposed to use more or most.
Most objectionable versus objectionablest.
Yes, good one. Okay. So yes, exactly. And if it's a one syllable word, then you always add ER or EST. So it's taller, tallest, not right. More tall. But then two syllable words are in this gray area. There's some rule about like sort of how you pick if it's a two syllable word, whether you use more or most or ER or EST. But it's like there's this clear rule for one syllable words and three syllable words or more.
I'd got it in my head, and I don't think I'm totally wrong about this, that there was a sort of Germanic romance thing going on in the difference between when we use more something or we put the est at the end of it. So Germanic things like, you know, biggest, but then it falls down in so many places because they're using the more thing to make something a superlative is a very French thing to do, right? They don't put something on the end of a word to make it a superlative. They put plus, and that makes it the most something. So it's a direct translation.
I think you're right, though. I was about to say this too. The EST ending is a Germanic suffix. Even the word most itself is a combination of words meaning like more and the EST ending.
It's the morest.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Oh. And like when we say like most. Upmost and things, these are always Germanic words. So it may feel, and a lot of Germanic words are, well, not a lot, but a decent amount of Germanic adjectives are monosyllabic. So adding the EST might sound older or more familiar and therefore more right. But of course, since 60% of our language is not that, then we've become more accustomed to other superlatives over time with the EST.
It's quite likely it's one of those constructions that the Normans gave us. It's the using the more thing, because there's no doubt that in Old English, to create a superlative, you are adding characters to the end of a sentence, to the end of a word, rather than using a word to make it as such. So it's definitely a French habit, but it doesn't fit. For example, commonest is a word. When you hear common, is very obviously a French derived word. Or large, I don't think large is a Germanic word, right? You wouldn't say more, the most large. Oh, I mean, you, well, the things you could, couldn't you?
Yeah, the one that always messes me up is clear, because you can say more clear or clearer. I like more clear, but I think you're supposed to say clearer because it's one syllable. So that one I am always like fighting the rule.
But. Yeah. And there are clearly more exceptions to this Romance versus Germanic thing than are sustainable.
It's definitely the current rule is definitely a syllable thing.
I think this probably leads into one of the other topics we wanted to get into, and that's flat adverbs like drive slow. Can you talk a little bit about that, Mignon?
A lot of pedants, as you'll say, will, you know, criticize signs that say drive slow. But that's a completely legitimate grammatical structure because English has this thing called flat adverbs, and slow is one. And so we have slowly is the regular adverb, slow is the flat adverb. We have closely is the regular adverb, but close is the flat adverb.
Stay close.
Stay close, listen closely, you know, so they have different, sometimes they have different meanings, but they don't always. Drive fast is another one. Fast is a flat adverb. And they are these adjectives that can function as adverbs. And we have them. We just do. They're like a normal part of English, but sometimes people have picked up on them and think, especially when there's two, when you have slow and slowly, people will say, well, you should use slowly, but we have slow, like we can use it if we want to. Actually, an interesting thing is that they used to be more common. So if you look at old writing, you'll see things like, it was violent hot, or he was horrid angry. Uh-huh. Those are all flat adverbs that, you know, we just kind of stopped using.
At school, you're told that an adverb is a li word, right? Mm-hmm. A word ending ly. And maybe it's just that. People aren't pleased to see them used otherwise. But sometimes, presumably, it is sort of clunky and incorrect. I wonder about usages like, I was hurt bad or something. Is that okay? Or should it always be badly?
Well, so bad isn't, for whatever reason, considered a flat adverb. A flat adverb. So there are instances where you are just getting it wrong. There's sort of a class of words. And like, why is slow a flat adverb and bad not? I have no idea. But yeah, but like bad is not a flat adverb. So you should say, you know, he swam badly or something like that.
In the other instances, hurt, if you are hurt badly, isn't that... badly is being used, or bad or badly is used as an adjective there, right?
Well, I say it depends on whether the person who hurt you did a bad job of it, right. In which case you've been hurt badly.
So maybe that's the distinction there. It's not necessarily being a flat adverb. It's masquerading as an adjective.
You got me. I was starting to go down the path of linking verbs versus action verbs. So, and because it comes up a lot with bad, like I feel bad or I feel badly, but that has to do with linking verbs and not flat adverbs.
Right. The degree to which one feels bad versus the mechanism by which you feel is working badly.
And so are these flat adverbs, are they interchangeable with the sort of standard form adverbs?
Usually. Like you drive slow and drive slowly, they mean the same thing. But there's some instances where they're different, like with close. So stand close, you could say stand closely, but that sounds kind of weird. You could say look closely, sounds more normal than like look close. Like right. Look closely at this paper, you know, look close at this paper. Like they're not wrong, but we tend to use them in different situations.
So much of grammar appears to be about feel, which is kind of unfair on learners, really, isn't it?
We've also discussed in the past that the ly ending that you see on many adverbs is cognate with the word like in English and other Germanic languages. So when you say Mignon phrased that cleverly, you were saying she phrased it clever like.
Oh, nice. So, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It just is the word like, which is fantastic. It's much more obvious in Dutch where they say like at the end.
Let's shift a little bit. I would love to know another thing that like sounds weird or can sound weird if you use it wrong, so to speak, would be we have some phrases that sound like they're supposed to be in certain orders, like binomials like salt and pepper or macaroni and cheese, but pepper and salt and macaroni and cheese sound wrong. Why do they sound wrong?
Yeah, cheese and macaroni sounds wrong.
Yeah, I love this topic. They're called frozen binomials. So there are these pairs of words we have, like macaroni and cheese, salt and pepper. You can only say them one way. They only sound normal one way. And linguists have been studying this for you know, at least 60 years, probably longer. I read one thing that said it went, studying this went back to like Sumeria. like it's been an age old question, but like studies have been done a lot. And linguists have come up with, you know, a lot of theories about what drives it. So there are exceptions to all of them. But typically the shorter word will come first. So like salt and pepper, salt is shorter. The person who has more power will come first. So often like king and queen, often that means the man comes first in a pair, but there are some instances where the woman will come first, like bride and groom. Ah. And they theorize because the bride is the center of attention at a wedding, then the more common thing will come first. So if you're talking about a horse and carriage, well, you know, we talk about horses more than we talk about carriages. So the more common word will come first.
You shouldn't put the carriage before the horse, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or it's cart.
Right.
That's what they say.
The more positive thing might come first. So friend or foe. Friend will come first because it's more positive. One thing that a lot of these have in common is that it's the word that's going to come to mind first when you're trying to think of the pair. You know, salt is more than pepper. Oh, and with macaroni and cheese, that goes to the rule that where the main things comes first. So it's macaroni with cheese.
Ah, yeah.
You know, it's ham with eggs. It's the thing that we think of as the main part of the meal that usually comes first.
We call it macaroni cheese in Britain. We don't call it macaroni and cheese. Yeah, we leave out the and. But it's sort of hinting at the same idea, right?
Yeah, it does the same thing.
Or would it be cheese? No, cheese macaroni actually makes more sense, doesn't it? Some cheesy macaroni.
Like a cheese sandwich.
Yeah. So linguists have been looking for patterns in why we do it like this. But does there have to be a pattern necessarily? Could these pairings, I like how I'm coming up with my own theory here, just in the middle of the podcast, but are they not just idiomatic pairings and that's why they sound more natural?
We have started saying them a certain way, and then we get used to hearing them a certain way. It's interesting, they can be flipped for, like in songs, usually we say day and night. And the order of events also, like if something happens first, then it comes first, like kiss and tell. Well, you have to kiss before you can tell. So that's the order of that. So like typically we think of day as coming before night, so day and night. But then there's the famous song, Night and Day. And then, you know, gin and tonic. Gin is the main part of the drink, and the tonic you just sort of add like the cheese to the Mac.
Yeah, Billy Joel says tonic and gin in one of his songs, doesn't he? And it catches your ear. It's effective.
Uh-huh. Exactly. And so it's for the rhyme. It can be said the other way, but we tend to stick with them because it just, the flat adverbs in certain instances, it just sounds right. And sometimes that's just what's governing language.
Sometimes it has to do with ablaut reduplication too, right? The like bing, bang, boom sound, order sound, right? Not every time, obviously. It seems the rules that you've outlined here, rules, so to speak, that you've outlined here take precedence over ablaut reduplication. But you always put like, you would say sing song and not song sing.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of a different thing because it's not like, I guess, yeah, sing and song are both things. Well, no, because sing is a verb. So, I mean, all the ones I'm thinking of aren't they all nouns? Like the horse before the cart, horse and cart, salt and pepper, mac and cheese, yeah. All nouns. Well, live and learn would be.
Oh, that would follow that pattern.
Yeah.
That also has to do with order, right?
Yeah, you have to live before you can learn.
But Jess has mentioned ablaut reduplication. Can we talk about that?
Can we dilly-dally on that for a while?
Yeah, there you go, exactly.
Let's keep away from the prittle-prattle.
There's an order, right? It's of the sounds.
It's always like tick-tock, ding-dong.
Ping-pong.
It always has to be the ih before the ah. And for some reason, we've decided that's the case. And if you say dong-ding, it sounds like a deliberate reversal.
It's like I-A-O, and then I think you can put E after the I or before it. Because you get like bric-a-brac, chit-chat, crisscross, pitter-patter. Just sounds more right.
Speaking of things that either sound right or wrong, I don't actually know how to pronounce this, by the way. Is it Osascomp? What is this?
Osascomp.
Osascomp.
I've only ever seen it written. We all said it differently.
I've only ever seen it written down. But this is about the order in which we use adjectives.
It's so wild in terms of like, you know, things that sound right. Because if you grow up speaking English, you just put your adjectives in this particular order. And the way I remember the order is this, it sort of sounds like a word, Osascomp. And it's opinion, size, age, shape, color, origin, material, and purpose. So, you know, you talk about the young American singer. So that's age comes before origin. So young American singer. If you say the American young singer, sounds completely wrong.
That's so strange.
Really, like as far as I can tell, nobody really knows why. You know, there's some hand waving about cognition in the brain and the speed with which we process different kinds of adjectives, but really, it like always comes back to it just sounds right to people this way.
It is in our heads, this order. We do not break it. You do not hear people breaking it, no matter their level of you know, education in the grammar of the English language. You either get it right or you get it wrong, and it sounds wrong if you do get it wrong. But it's a thing.
And it's another place where I feel sorry for people who are learning English, because it's another thing that they kind of have to memorize that we just do naturally.
We create examples when they are tied to like storytelling and things. Like Big Bad Wolf violates it. It also it doesn't violate ablaut reduplication, but it does violate osiscomp, because bad is the opinion.
Bad's opinion. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So should he bad the bad big wolf?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'll try that next time. Next time I'm reading it to my little girl.
I've seen in other instances where sometimes ablaut reduplication can revert in other scenarios to like the big ugly bear or something like that. Poor bear. I bet he's very handsome. The big handsome bear.
There are also times when it can change the meaning. So when I talked about the green square tile, you know, if I have a wall full of square tiles and I want to point one out to you, I would say there's the green square tile. But if I have a wall of green tiles and they're all different shapes, I might say there's the square green tile. But depending on like what you're pointing out among a sea of something else, you can change the order to draw attention to the thing you want to draw attention to. So like the rule doesn't hold up like all the time, and sometimes it can change meaning. But in general, people do follow the rule.
Mm-hmm. You would say things like a pretty new red silk dress. That's how that order would go.
It's interesting because English is more flexible than a lot of other languages in how we order things in sentences. It's just on this, it's very picky. Like in German, there's this thing, time, manner, place, and you're supposed to, when you construct your sentence, give those bits of information in that order: time, when it's happening, how it's happening, and where it's happening, before you probably get to your second verb at the end to try and surprise you. But in English, we can rearrange those things and it's all right. So it's bizarre that we have this prescriptive way of ordering our adjectives like this. Bizarre.
I just noticed that. I just started doing Duolingo German and I'm like, what do you mean I can't put Wirklich anywhere in the sentence? You know, like in English, I could put that anywhere.
Imagine the Germans not being flexible.
Oh no. Totally out of character.
Ring the stereotype bell.
What you were saying, Mignon, about whenever it's not flexible, it creates difficulties for non-native English speakers, because there are a number of examples of like, it, for another example, is collocation. We have collectively decided that it sounds right for certain words to stick together. And it sounds a little odd when you choose a different version, like you would say deeply regret, happily married, woefully ignorant. And those words sound like they go together because we have repeated them together in media and in literature for so long. They sound functional. And we do it with simple verb phrases that include like do time or go astray or make a difference. There's no necessary reason why doing time should be the more common phrase than like spending time, which we also do, but you say do time in a particular scenario to indicate that you're spending time in prison.
Yeah, it comes up with prepositions a lot too for people who are learning English. Like, am I in a restaurant or am I at a restaurant? And it's like, well, both, maybe sometimes, it depends. And there's something to do with like transportation, modes of transportation. Like, are you in a boat or on a boat? And it depends on like what the boat is doing. It's tough. It's really tough.
I think a lot of learners would say that is the major peculiarity of English, is its use of prepositions, particularly prepositional, you know, verbs, where we group prepositions to differentiate them. Why is to wipe up and to wipe out? You know, mm-hmm.
They're very different in the
vastly different things.
Connotations.
Yeah, I have a LinkedIn learning course on writing with plain language. And one of the pieces of advice is to try to avoid phrasal verbs, because ESL speakers have a much harder time comprehending phrasal verbs. So if you can, it's always better to choose the the action, you know, the one word verb.
One I always think of in, when I'm playing these off against each other is give up and surrender, right?
Oh, there you go.
That's easier, a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. It's easier to say surrender than to say to give up. But it only works in a certain situation.
Yeah.
To give out is very different. To give off right. is also very different. And yeah. you don't want to say, I'm giving off something.
And it's because
you're actually giving it up.
Preposition use has been like so arbitrary for like its entire history. If you look back at like the earlier meanings of like at and on and by, they could mean completely different things than they do now. That kind of reminds me of on accident versus by accident. I feel like these are very interchangeable now, but some people are pedantic about it, right?
I am. I'm not having on accident. Don't tell me that's okay.
Really? That sounds wrong to you?
On accident sounds absolutely wrong. What I think has happened there is someone has thought of on purpose. And you know, these two ideas of it being accidental or intentional, and they've just taken the on from on purpose and they put it before accident. That's what I think has happened. But I know this is something I'm going to have to learn to live with, isn't it?
Well, this is actually really an interesting one too, because there was a linguist who studied this particular phenomenon and found that it was directly age-related. So if you were born before 1970, you will say by accident. And if you were born after 1995, you will say on accident. And like in between those years, it's like you can say, people tend to say either. And nobody knows why this happened. Nobody knows why young people just started saying on accident at some point. I really deeply in my heart, I believe it has to be some sort of mass media phenomenon. There has to have been a cartoon or something like that that kids heard around that time that caused them to start saying it differently. Because you will hear people argue that it's like, oh, well, you know, we're seeking parallelism. It's on purpose. So then they're seeking parallelism by saying on accident. And it's like, I don't know any six-year-olds who seek parallelism, you know, and why would they have just started doing it in, you know, 1975, you know? So I just do not buy the seeking parallelism argument about why it happened. Like it might be why it persisted, but I just think it has to be some mass media event that caused kids to start saying it differently.
Probably an American one, because that sounds perfectly normal to me, having been born in 1990, and Rob's a couple years older than me and British, so, and that's...
Yeah, I must say, I don't think I've heard on accident out of a British mouth, actually, ever. I think that's why it just sounds
you're right.
So strange to me.
It was Barney.
It was Barney.
I have no proof it was Barney, but I suspect.
Let's blame it all on Barney. He's not going to fight back. He's a peace-loving guy.
Speaking of younger folks and their terms, you reminded me in the prep for this episode of one of my favorite internet-isms, and it's because internet, right?
People actually think that might have started with Saturday Night Live. The phenomenon is you say like, my report's going to be late. Because
reasons.
Because reasons. Yeah, because reasons. Yeah, I'm trying to think of a good reason. Because reasons. And, you know, people didn't always say that. Like, you might say because of reasons. That was a way you might have said it. And because is normally a conjunction. You know, you would say, my assignment's going to be late because the dog ate it, you know, or something like that. And then you could say because of my dog. And now we just say because dog.
When we do that, we're doing it knowingly, aren't we? Aren't people doing it knowingly?
It's still kind of a slangy thing. Yeah, it's not like you're not going to find it in an annual report for a bank. You
know? It's like people know that they are flouting a rule, and it's funny, right? It's a funny way to flout that rule.
It reads to me as a Twitterism, because I guess that's probably where I saw it. And it's also, it requires fewer characters than adding an extra preposition or something. That's also the name of a wonderful book, Because Internet, by Gretchen McCulloch, who is a linguist who studies the way people talk online.
Right. Yeah, I have it right here.
Yeah, we probably all got a copy of it somewhere.
Great book up there. Yeah. So people actually think, Neil Whitman wrote about this for me. A linguist named Neil Whitman wrote about for me many years ago, I think, like, I don't know, back in 2012 or something like that. And people think that it started with Saturday Night Live. They had a recurring skit where they would say something about, like, I don't quite understand it, but like, if you're falling, pretend to be a dummy because someone might catch you. Hey, free dummy. and somehow that hey became a thing. So like when life gives you lemons, keep them because hey, free lemons. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. And then it was like because hey, And then the thought is that eventually people dropped the hay. So now, like, you know, if life gives you lemons, keep them because free lemons. And so they dropped the hay. And so the thinking is that, like, that's where it came from and that's how it evolved. And then, yeah, it's just fun to say. And initially it also, in a lot of times, would have a sense of it being a bad reason or a ridiculous reason.
If you say because internet, you're blaming something far too big to actually be the reason.
Because right? Science.
Right. And, yeah. But I think it has it's gone beyond that initial place where the reason was always bad. And now people just kind of use it with any reason. So I think it's sort of expanding like that, but it's still kind of considered slang. You're not going to hear a bank say, you know, interest rates are up because inflation.
Which actually, I mean, it's good explanation. Why not?
That's a fun, I don't know, grammar twist that reminds me of nouning and verbing, like nouning our verbs and verbing our nouns, which we talk about a lot. Obviously, this is a storied and noble tradition in the English language, for Shakespeare hath been doing this for many, many a millennia.
He used ghosted, which right. I like.
Unfriend, things like that, which I guess that's, yeah.
To portcullis, he used that as well. To dog as well, that's a Shakespeare.
Back formations too are basically the same thing. Like when it's more likely to adopt a T-I-O-N noun into English directly from French or Latin, and then we reverb it. We make, like, evaluate, regurgitate, exploit, destruct became English words after evaluation, regurgitation, exploitation, and destruction.
My favorite back formation is edit. We had editors first, and then later we got the verb edit to edit. Same with babysit. We initially had babysitters, and then later we got the verb babysit.
Oh, that's fun.
But we're terribly resistant to these nowadays, right? I mean, people are terribly resistant. I'm terribly resistant to them. I get very upset if someone says they're going to inbox me, for example. don't tell me that. Or they're going to calendar something.
Some of them sound like corporatisms nowadays.
Maybe that's why it is. Maybe because I only hear those in corporate contexts. But it is a normal thing. And there's one that you mentioned, Mignon, which is versing. I've actually never come across this. So I don't have my finger on the pulse at all.
You're not a gamer, right?
No.
That'll do it.
No. Well, I mean, Scrabble.
Yeah, right.
No, it's so interesting. Like, I started getting, you know, calls from listeners who would be like, my kid, they always thought their childhood made it up, right? So they'd say, my kid is using the word versing. They just made it up with their friends. But it actually goes back to at least the 1980s. And it seems like it probably comes from gaming, computer games. You know, you talk about player A versus player B. And, you know, if you think about it, like, again, if you think about the grammar, like, it kind of makes sense that kids would extend it, because you might say, like, Sue dances with Bob, right? Mm-hmm. And then you say Sue is dancing with Bob. So if you're saying, like, player A versus player B, well, then it makes sense to say player A is versing player B.
Yeah.
Like it follows the same pattern. And so that's where it comes from, people think.
So it should be versusing then, really, if we're going to apply it, right? Because the us at the end of versus is not the same as at the end of dancers. This is quite a common thing, actually. There was a TV show that was very popular called Man Versus Food, but in that they always pronounced it Man Verse Food. It used to drive them potty.
I hate that.
Yeah, I hate that too. It's the name of the show. You know, you can't just knock off a couple of letters. I don't know why. But that is happening with versing, right? Because it should be versusing.
It is. Yeah. And kids will say, I verse him. Yeah. They will use verse without verses.
And we've got to get used to it. I mean, I've never come across it, but it's going to.
Another place it comes up, I've heard, is in schools. You know, like if you're saying, is a substitute for playing, our school is versing the other school in a spelling bee, because you're not really playing a spelling bee, right? So versing also, like, fills this gap that kind of makes sense in certain situations.
One of these, a variation on a similar phenomenon that's been taking up too much brain space of mine lately, is I've been writing for dictionary.com's slang dictionary, and occasionally they'll send me one that I'm like, I haven't heard of before, because it's like Gen Alpha slang. And the one I'm still trying to wrap my head around a little bit is girding. It means, but it also doesn't mean, to do something smart but dangerous, but it's often associated with memes of things that are don't seem smart but dangerous to me. So it's got like 10 different recursive associations with different memes, but ultimately it's a shortening of the word yogurt, which was made into the sentence yo gert, and then gert became a character, and then girding became a thing that the character would do. And of course there's going to be someone who watches this and is like, that's not what that means. But maybe I'll know next week once I finish writing this.
Yeah, I haven't heard that one either. That's wild.
Thank you, Mignon. This has been the funnest time. We're so excited to have had you on our show.
I am most delighted to have been here.
Do you have any new books coming up? Would you like to plug your podcast?
Yeah. Check out my podcast, Grammar Girls, Quick and Dirty Tips for Better Writing, with more than 1,000 episodes. Anything you might want to know about language, it's probably there. And we have a lot of fun.
Grab the Grammar Daily. It's really fun.
I've got one as well. This is Grammar Girls Quick and Dirty Tips for Better Writing, if you want to write better. She didn't ask us to plug any of this. I should point this out. We're doing it because
we're books.
Yeah. Mignon's here because we like what she does. And thank you so much for doing it on our humble little podcast. Not quite 1,000 episodes, although I think we're around about 50 by now. But thank you so much once again for joining us.
Thank you.
See y'all next time.